Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 2:04 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is July 24th, today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would kick off with the long-term view of the Dow Gold ratio because I think it is one of the biggest anomalies we've seen in a century trend has been completely compromised, and that I think is something that we need to pay particular attention to because it calls into question the predictability of long-term cycles. And are we now in a completely different environment is something that I think needs to be considered, and it's something that's likely to frame the investment outlook for the foreseeable future. Until quite recently, it was easy enough to think about the long-term secular theme that there was going to be a very significant secular trend in equities versus precious metals, that we could have anticipated that based upon the cycle of equity bubbles, that you had this massive move in the 1920s, another massive move from the 1950s through to the mid-1960s, and then another big move from the early 1980s all the way through until 1999. The peaks were approximately 35 years apart, and we also had the clear very significant moves by gold to outperform on a prolonged basis, and also the tendency of oil to outperform the equity market around the same time. And I think perhaps that is also one of the big changes that we've had, because when we start to think about the long-term history of the stock market relative to oil, well, then we're in a rather interesting environment, because then it's quite different. When we think about the pattern that we've had over the course of the last decade, and then simply overlay what we've seen now with Dow oil, then it's extraordinarily different. For one thing, we can go back a little bit further. We can go back to the 1900s. We had a significant peak in 29, in 65, again in 2000, and now we've had this extraordinary peak in terms of this collapse in the oil price against a background where the stock market did not pull back by as much, and we've had this very significant retracement of that accelerated peak, but it is still above the 600 level. Now, this is very similar to what we might have anticipated seeing from the Dow gold ratio, that it would have pushed on to new high ground, that we would eventually have seen a peak around the mid-2030s. It's quite likely that this peak in the Dow oil ratio is the peak for this cycle. Now, that's a significant development. Rather than thinking about gold for a moment, let's just simply think about oil, that the oil price has been largely range-bound now for most of the last 5 years, and it got up to approximately $45 in here this week, but wasn't quite able to hold it, and has come back a little. The amplitude of the trading has compressed, not least because of the exaggerated decline that we had in March and April, but subsequently prices have been steady around the just above the $40 area. But I think it is much more instructive to look at the very long-term chart for oil prices. And we probably need to do it on a very long-term basis to see that we still have the steps. And this is, in fact, even, I think, more profound, because in the course of oil's history, over the course of more than a century, where we have, and I'm not at all sure why it's not putting giving us as much data as it has in the past. There we go. Well, what it would have been reasonable to expect was that we would never have seen oil come back below the $30 level on a closing monthly basis, but it did get all the way down to about $19 or $18 in March. That's the first time it's dipped into an underlying range ever in the course of more than 100 years of history. It really does suggest that we're in a very different environment, and it raises very big questions. Now, one thing that I think we can continue to expect is that it is unlikely that oil prices are going to rally significantly, that we still have this sequence of lower rally highs, and we have got the potential for resistance to come through in the region of the upper or the lower side of the overhead trading range, which is around the $45 area. Well, then let's go back and think about what does that price look like? And this time I'm looking at West Texas Intermediate because it's the basis for that long-term chart. Well, we clearly then have the potential here for resistance to come through in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range. And it's right in the region of the trend mean. It is a very important area where we need to see demand coming back into dominance. Obviously, oil is not simply about the energy price. It's also about the outlook for global growth. And then there is the additional argument that you have the petrodollar and that the oil price and oil as a commodity are euphemisms for the basis for all economic activity, since you really can't do anything without energy. So now the question is, are we going to see prices pop above this $40 area and get back towards $60? Or are we going to see a continued period of ranging between about $40 and $20? I think the clearest corollary that we have for oil prices is natural gas. Natural gas prices have been ranging in a volatile manner for more than a decade already. And they are still really quite depressed, although prices have certainly appreciated somewhat in here this week. But it is, I think, more likely than not that what we're going to see with oil is being approximated by natural gas. And it has been ranging between approximately $180 and $4 for most of the last decade. There have been occasional scurries up to about $6, but they've never been sustained. And every time we get a significant rally, the price comes right back down in a very abrupt manner. Part of the reason for this new this inability to hold rallies is because of the elasticity in supply that is now available as a result of unconventional drilling represented by horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. These types of wells are not like conventional wells because they can be basically turned on and off based upon the drilling activity. When prices are high, it encourages speculative activity and more drilling. When prices are low, they simply stop drilling and supply contracts again. Well, in order for us to then see a significant rebound, then there are only two possible ways that that could happen. It's either that demand has to increase in a big way in order to completely overwhelm supply, or the ability to continue to turn supply on and off has to be inhibited. And the only way that's going to happen is if we see massive bankruptcies. Well, when we look at the high yield energy spread, then it did pop on the upside back in March. It got all the way up to just a very significant move. And I think now we've had a significant contraction again. So that is at least unwinding some of the potential that we're going to see a rash of bankruptcies. But what's much more likely is we're going to see consolidation, and that the much bigger companies are going to take over the better properties. We're going to see rationalization of the drilling process, and they will attempt to reduce the marginal cost of production. But by reducing the marginal cost of production, that only increases the quantity of oil that will be available to the market. And it is likely, therefore, that the price trend will range for a significant period of time. What that also potentially suggests is that we're unlikely to see a major bull market in oil, and therefore it's unlikely that the Dow oil ratio is going to contract in a very meaningful fashion. But of course, in order for it to contract, all that would need to happen is for oil to stay sideways and then a significant decline to occur in the stock market. But a significant move in the stock market, I think, is unlikely, although we are potentially now due some consolidation. When, for example, we look at the Dow Jones, it has rebounded right back up to the upper side of the range that's persisted now for most of the last 2.5 years. It's a logical area where we might anticipate some resistance, and certainly the price has paused. So we may see some additional consolidation. I don't think that that's an unreasonable expectation. The bigger question is about the NASDAQ. It has surged higher over the course of the last 3 or 4 months, and it pulled back rather sharply in here this week. We had a very clear downside key reversal about 2 weeks ago. We had a big pullback yesterday, and I was mentioning the 13,350 area yesterday as the lower side of the range. It dipped below it for a brief period in here today and then closed back above it. So far, we still have this sequence of ranges, one above another, and the ranges are relatively similar sized. Now, as long as that remains the case, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But if we do see the lows from today and from last week getting taken out on a sustained basis, then that would increase the scope for a process of mean reversion. And the NASDAQ has approximately 1,300 points in which to consolidate and still be above its trend mean. But the much bigger picture is about thinking about that Dow-gold ratio, because gold prices have surged in here this week, and they have closed above $1,900. Now, we are within striking distance of the all-time peak. I think it is rather important to simply highlight that this move is much more dynamic in nature than the brief period where prices were able to sustain above the $1,900 area back in 2011. And this is a weekly chart. We can see, for example, that the move above $1,900 was not sustained. And that's, I think, one of the more important points. That if we go back and think about the trend at that time, then it certainly rallied really quite impressively to get up to those levels, and moved from approximately $1,400 to $1,900 in really quite a swift period of time. So that was a clear acceleration of the trend, which until that point had been really quite orderly, with a series of ranges above another. But one thing that we can also think about in terms of the overall trend in the market is that even this orderly period of trending and ranging that really began after the big pullback in 2008, that was already an acceleration of the trend that had clearly been underway for the decade previous. Because prior to that, we'd had these extremely lengthy ranges going on for approximately 18 months. And then they tended to break out in the Septembers of uneven years. So we had a breakout in 2007. We had another breakout in September, October of 2009. The breakout before that had occurred in the period of September 2005. Prior to that, it had been September, October of 2003. And these lengthy ranging phases had always been concluded by extremely powerful breakouts, where prices went up in a very meaningful manner for a reasonably prolonged period of time. So one thing that became the hallmark of the last period of trending and ranging in the gold market was the tendency to have explosive breakouts and then to have lengthy periods of consolidation. Now, when we think about the peak, we had the acceleration following what had been an orderly period. So this, there is one thing that we can anticipate from trends as they develop. It's that they should become more consistent, because the imbalance between supply and demand should widen. In any secular trend, it takes time for people to become truly convinced of the bull market environment. There are a couple of things that convince them. The first is the persistence of higher prices. So prices break out and then they stay higher for longer, and people might originally start thinking that prices are too high to buy, then they become conditioned to accept the higher price, so then they're willing to pay more for whatever the asset is. Then there will always be a story that's associated with the new bull market. It takes time for people to believe in it. It takes time for people to have the confidence that it will persist, and in fact that the trend of and the efficacy of the bullish argument has to eventually become self-fulfilling. When that occurs, people then become more eager to buy and the trend becomes more consistent. These types of trends eventually end when all doubt is dispelled, when people are falling over themselves to buy in because they are very fearful of missing out on the opportunity, and that the trend has been self-fulfilling for so long that people think it will last indefinitely, and that it's still in the early stages of the market, so that they can speculate with the perception of low risk. And that's usually when manias occur. And we did have acceleration in 2011. Well, then let's go back and think about the environment that we have right now. Because we've had a really quite impressive breakout. The move started in 2019, and it has really been moving higher now for approximately a year already. And we are right in the region of the all-time peaks, but it is certainly a new closing high for gold in US dollars. And it is finally catching up with the strong performance that gold has put in a range of additional currencies. When we look at Australian dollars, gold has clearly bounced from the region of the trend mean and is pushing back up towards the peaks, but it had been pushing on to new all-time highs in early 2019 already. When we look at it in other commodity-producing currencies, then the weakness of commodities generally has greatly flattered the outlook for gold. Canadian dollars as well had trended downwards for a reasonably prolonged period, so gold is breaking out in pretty emphatic fashion against it. Then when we think about safe haven assets like the Swiss franc, gold is at a new all-time high and had broken out to, or at least posted new highs in March already. The Japanese yen is another currency that tends to do well in periods of stress, and gold was breaking out against it more than a year ago. So what we are in fact seeing right now is clear evidence that gold is appreciating in every currency. And that is true of emerging market currencies like the Chinese renminbi, where gold is now at clear new highs and rallying in a dynamic manner. It's equally true of the Indian rupee, where we've had a very significant breakout over the course of the last year, and now the pace of that advance is picking up. Now let's go back and think about the Dow gold ratio, because I think that this is a very significant event that's been occurring over the last 18 months, that gold has clearly, or that equity markets have been clearly underperforming now for a pretty prolonged period. And we saw a break in the sequence of higher reaction lows off the March low in here this week. So gold is now back in a period of outperformance relative to the Dow Jones. But obviously, the first argument there would be that not only has it been outperforming, but there's been a clear pattern of outperformance by of or underperformance of stocks versus gold since the end of 2018. When we then think about the Nasdaq versus gold, well, then we get an additional picture, but it's not as exaggerated. But certainly, there is a sequence of lower rally highs, and the ratio dropped below the 200-day moving average in here this week. When we start to think about what exactly is going on here, we can ask, I think, two separate questions. And unfortunately, there isn't a real good answer to these questions. The first of answer or the first question has to be, well, if the ratio is no longer consistent, and we look at the Dow gold ratio and the beautiful cyclicality that it had from approximately 1900 through to approximately 2018, and there is a clear trend underway now that is completely different to anything we've seen in that 120 years. Is the ratio still valid? Or is it still appropriate to think about the constituents of the ratio in the same way that we would have 120 years ago? So those are, I think, two related questions. Well, we're probably going to have to wait about 30 years until we have a conclusive answer. So we are going to have to make some kind of guess. The first, I think, big point is about the quantity of debt. We are in a really very interesting period in the debt cycle overall. 90% of all government bonds in the world today have yields of less than 1%, and the total number of or the total quantity of bonds that have got negative yields is still trending higher, and is almost up to 15 trillion as of this week. So we've had a very significant contraction in government bond yields everywhere. When we think about the UK, the 10-year gilt is now at about 14 basis points. It did pop on the upside in here today, having come back to the lows in March. Now the question that I think investors are beginning to ask is about inflation and whether bonds in fact represent value here. When we think about the German Bund, Germany has benefited enormously from negative interest rates, but yields have popped on the upside in here in here today as well. I think we are presented with another little interesting teaching opportunity here. Over the last month, you can see that there has been a downward bias to the range, and the range has been largely going sideways. The yield, at the lows in here today was pretty similar to the lows put in back at the beginning of the month. But the dynamics are all on the upside. We've had clear stabs on the upside, even within the range that has had a mild downward bias overall. If it can string together two of those stabs on the upside, it will clearly signal that yields are about to move north from here. When we then think about the 10-year Treasury yield, 10-year Treasuries have been completely inert over the course of the last 4 months. There has been, and I think it's almost like double speak when the Federal Reserve talks. They have said nothing about introducing a standing repo facility, but that is effectively what is in place, because if for any reason repo rates were to spike higher, then the Federal Reserve would step in immediately and supply as much liquidity as is required. The last time they did that, it was in the order of $400 to $500 billion, and the most important thing to understand about the repo market is that it exposes the Federal Reserve's balance sheet to unlimited liability. So, in the event that there is a problem in the repo market, because the USA is the reserve currency holder, they have got to step in and provide liquidity, regardless of what the issue is that is animating that change. Of course, they haven't come out and said that in concrete terms, but it is, in fact, the reality. Now, when we think about the yield curve, well, the yield curve spread in normal circumstances would have been surging higher already. Usually, when we get an inversion, the spread marches higher in a very swift manner, and not least because interest rates come down in an aggressive manner, and this steepening of the yield curve allows the banking sector to be recapitalized in a swift manner, and then that affords them, in a classic situation, the largesse to begin lending once more. Well, that has not happened on this occasion because the Federal Reserve cannot, and more importantly, the US Treasury, they simply can't afford to move into additional negative territory. There are a number of central banks around the world who have dallied with negative interest rates over the course of the last decade, most particularly Japan and the EU. Neither were able to get off the zero bound before the current crisis, and they may be forced into, and in fact, with nearly 15 trillion of sovereign bonds in negative yielding territory, then they are still under pressure to cut interest rates in here at present. The Federal Reserve has resisted the temptation to move into negative interest rates, so have the UK, although the bond market is increasingly pricing in the potential that the UK will in fact go for negative interest rates at some point next year. Well, they can't go into negative interest rates if they want to rescue the banking sector, but if they want to try and assist the banking sector, they need to provide a lot more liquidity. What it in fact suggests is that they are simply going to nationalize the banks, but it's going to be similar to the same kind of policy regime that they've introduced with the repo market. They've also, in the yield curve, said that they're not engaged in yield curve control, but the reality, when we simply look at the facts in the market, then it's been ranging for most of the last few months. The spread has been incredibly inert, relative to the clear trending environment that would normally have been expected. So we have de facto yield curve control. Now the big question is, are they going to simply nationalize the banks, but without in fact nationalizing them? Will they simply then just go ahead and provide them with the liquidity and instruct them what to do with it? because that's exactly what the PPP program has been in the USA as a result of the stimulus that was announced in response to the rescue package from the lockdowns from the coronavirus. It's quite likely that that is exactly what's going to happen, that the balance sheets of the retail banking sector will be taken over and lending will take place as a result. And there is good reason for that, considering that banks, one of the primary reasons we did not have inflation after the credit crisis in 2008 was that there was a massive amount of liquidity provided to the banks and they did not lend it out. And by withholding that liquidity from the market, they dampened down inflationary pressures, which helped asset prices to inflate, but not inflation in the wider economy. Well, right now, the governments of the world, they need inflation. And when we think about the outlook for the global economy, well, TIPS yields are pricing in inflation, and in no uncertain terms, that the yield right now is at a negative 91 basis points. If we take the TIPS yield and we then take away the Treasury yield, well, then we're provided with the break-even yield. And that is the market measure for inflation, which is trending higher. It's up to 1.5%, and it is in a clear uptrend. Well, now the question is, how long is it before markets begin to price in that we're now at the beginning of a new inflationary cycle? Because that is the most likely scenario, that, and I think the closest corollary, or the closest historical precedent, is the late 1960s, where we had massive student protests, where the French government was worried that it was going to amount to a revolution, that there was the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy within 3 months of each other. There was this massive student protest movement, and that is in fact much more aggressive than what we've seen recently, but the response from government is similar, that they panicked and they started to print money. They had the Federal Reserve to simply finance the government debts. It was outright debt monetization. Now, we are still on the borders of debt monetization today. It's not completely outright just yet. The Federal Reserve is still talking about how they are going to manage inflationary expectations, what they're going to do with interest rates, and they're likely to start talking about how they're going to measure inflation. But the reality is that they simply cannot raise interest rates because of the damage that would do in terms of global, or I guess their ability, or the government's ability to service the debt. The interest rate payment right now on the outstanding debt is approximately 7 to 8 billion. If they were to raise interest rates by 2%, it would be in the order of 100 billion. That's well in excess of the entire budget for education. So these are very significant issues for the USA. They are equally significant for just about everywhere else. That's why gold is rallying in every currency, because these types of challenges are being faced by every country. It means that interest rates have to stay lower for longer because of the potential for clear economic contraction if interest rates rise too early. It means that they have simply no choice than to run inflation hot. And that, I think, is more likely than not. We're already seeing market expectations for inflation rising. We've seen gold breaking out in just about all currencies, so this is a significant development. Gold tends to do best when it is appreciating in all currencies for the simple reason that it is a monetary metal. It does best when there is a clear negative real interest rate environment. This is rather different to the kind of environment that we had in the early 2000s. There was still talk about financial repression back in the early 2000s because interest rates were kept lower for longer in response to the bursting of the TMT bubble, technology, media, and telecoms. But then we had inflationary pressures starting to pick up because of commodity prices. This is quite different. We are not seeing the kind of pressure from commodity price inflation on this occasion. It's rather different. In fact, we didn't really have inflationary pressures picking up then either. It was more about the significant commodity price inflation that people were assuming that inflation would pick up. If we really think about it, that inflation is a monetary phenomenon, and it is now that we're seeing this massive monetary accommodation, and the likelihood that it will persist is the clear rationale for why inflation should start to pick up. Now, of course, it is not going to pick up until the velocity of money starts to pick up. And we are still at a point where people are worried in the short term about the coronavirus. The number of deaths hit a new high in California today. It hit a new high in Florida. And there are still resistance movements out there to wearing masks. But we are coming towards a peak in the infection rate. It simply takes people some time to get around to the idea that they need to, in fact, not simply talk about social distancing, but in fact perform it. And we will see the number of cases decline. We're also likely to have a vaccine by the end of this year. We still don't know exactly what the immune response is from the body's perspective. We don't know how long antibodies and T cells provide immunity. It's impossible to know that without additional data. We really only have data that's about 6 months old. So far, the estimates for how long immunity lasts are about 6 months. We haven't, in fact, seen anybody become reinfected after a 6-month interval. So we don't really know how long it's going to take for people to lose their immunity, or indeed whether that immunity lasts indefinitely. We don't know how long vaccines will last, but it is likely we're going to have vaccines. And we will find out a way to re-engage with economic activity. And when that occurs, then the velocity of money will pick back up. We're going to have a very different economy than we did going into this crisis. Every crisis results in weak businesses going bust. One challenge with this crisis is that a lot of zombie companies have been rescued, and that will potentially lead to less economic growth in future. But the big question is, how will governments respond in terms of monetary policy? Because the clear rationale here is that people have had enough of dealing with lower standards of living. We've had a significant populist movement erupt in the countries where manufacturing has slowed down the most. And if we go back and think about the fact, I remember when, as a child, the town where I grew up had a shoe factory. Well, there is practically no town in Ireland today has a shoe factory. The leather goods from Spain and Italy were part of the fabric of the economy, and now they have essentially been limited to highly luxury brands, but day-to-day production of leather goods has largely disappeared. And the production of all of these labor-intensive but reasonably well-paid jobs has simply disappeared. And the problem that was never really addressed is that manufacturing is the primary route for less educated people to attain a middle-class lifestyle. And the kinds of jobs that replace them, whether that is in call centers, in supermarkets, or as personal trainers, all these low-end service positions pay less. They also are, but they don't deliver on the kind of job security that one would have had, one of the reasons why manufacturing classically paid more money was because of the cyclicality of the industry, that during a recession, a lot of factories either cut wages or cut hours or closed down and then opened back up again when the economy did better. That meant that manufacturing jobs tended to ebb and flow with the economy. Now, you simply don't have the reward, but you still have the risk. And that is, I think, one of the primary factors behind the rise of the populist movement. On top of that, the evolution of the pension schemes, where you no longer have defined benefit, and instead you're provided with a defined contribution, it exposes the worker to a lot more volatility in terms of pricing. Obviously, it is better for the companies because their exposure to risk from the pensions is considerably contained, but it is an additional fact that creates volatility in the lives of workers, and when things don't go right for a prolonged period, well, then you get populist uprisings. Well, we've had these massive populist uprisings. The majority of them have come down on the side of right-wing populists. And stock markets generally like right-wing populists because they tend to be market-friendly. And even in Mexico, where a left-wing populist won the election, he, in fact, has been largely blunted in terms of what he's been able to implement. And he was unable to change the ownership of companies. He was unable to really significantly change big parts of the economy. And yet the stock market pulled back pretty persistently since he's taken over. Now, that's without any major change. Well, then let's think about the fact that we've got major elections coming up in the USA. The S&P 500 is in the region of the trend mean. It has been able to push back above it, and I think that's a really quite impressive feat. But the big question is, are we going to see the price do well? And there are, I think, I really don't know why the Bloomberg is not working here. Unfortunately, this does seem to be happening on a more regular basis where you put in a chart and it just doesn't come up. We're right in the region of the trend mean for the S&P 500. It has been consolidating here. I think we are due some additional consolidation. It's done better than the Dow Jones. It is above the 3,000 level. It has room in which to consolidate. But the big question is, are we going to get a new populist left-wing government coming through to power in the USA? Now, if that is the case, then we are likely to see a very significant period of volatility. We are likely to see the clear implementation of debt monetization. Much of the policy program of Bernie Sanders has been adopted by the Democratic Party, and it's likely that they are going to go for straight out debt monetization. Well, that's clearly inflationary, They will paper over the potential for deficits to expand significantly by raising taxes on the very wealthy and potentially the less wealthy, and that is likely to have a significant deleterious effect on the stock market. It will rob investors of a sense of security. And one thing that we can certainly say about the stock market is it is much less consistent today than it had been in the entire bull market up from the lows in 2008. It's quite unusual for a market to pull back below the 1,000-day moving average. The S&P did, the NASDAQ did not, but now the question is whether it is going to be capable of holding the region of 3,000. I think we're due some consolidation. Part of the reason we're due consolidation is because of the uncertainty, not only because of the political environment, the rise of populism, the lurch to the right, then the subsequent lurch to the left. We haven't seen the lurch to the left yet, but it is quite likely a potential outcome. Because when people are looking, when the status quo breaks, people look for an alternative. They try one alternative and they see what happens. If they don't get exactly what they want, which is more money, better standards of living, then an additional upstart movement arises and that gets into power, and people will continue to move for greater extremes of a policy until they get what they want. Once the status quo has been broken, we are in a very different environment. And that is as true of domestic politics in the USA as it is in Europe. One thing that is quite different in Europe today is that the dollar is now breaking downwards, and by extension, the euro is breaking higher. It closed on its highs for the week. It has very clearly broken the 2.5-year downtrend. And this is a significant move, because one thing that is happening in Europe is that the status quo has also been broken. It's been easy to think about the upstart movements that have occurred in Italy as being a significant event, or Brexit being a significant event. And I think that obviously Brexit is a significant event, but it's also a contributing event, because the bulk of commentary has been about the repercussions of Brexit on the UK economy. What's it going to mean for the UK? The UK has an opportunity to move into a more pronounced period of growth, to adapt to the global environment and to compete on a very aggressive basis. Now, that is going to have to be pursued in a very significant and aggressive manner if it's going to placate the populist masses. The Boris Johnson government was able to succeed because they turned a large number of Labour voters. To placate those people, they need to deliver on higher standards of living. And that means more money. It means more jobs. And it means an answer to the clear question that's been arising for most of the last 40 years, which is what is going to replace domestic manufacturing. Now, if they fail to come up with an answer to that question, then there was quite likely to be a lurch to the left in the UK. But they still have time in which to do it. Now it's time to think about what the response to the populist uprising in Italy and the Brexit movement in the UK has been inside Europe. Because from a macro perspective, it has thrown the European Union into a state of chaos, they have had to make a very clear decision. Are they going to continue upon the stated objective of harmonizing debt to GDP ratios over the course of the next decade, or are they going to move aggressively now to pioneer further or further cohesion earlier? The slow burn debt to GDP cohesion was really about ensuring that creditors were not inconvenienced and that debtors were really made to pay for their mistakes. And that is just simply not going to work. So now there is a willingness to accept fiscal cohesion, grants to the debtors. In other words, the sins of the period before the sovereign wealth crisis are in the process of being forgiven. And then that is something that is, in fact, pushing increasingly towards further cohesion in the EU. And it kind of suggests that the massive changes that are evolving now could be something that will accelerate the pace of cohesion and the creation of a United States of Europe. There is no doubt that Europe needs it. They need to stand with a unified voice versus the increasing onslaught of Chinese expansion and the greater competition rather than cooperation that a populist regime in the US represents. So it's Europe's choice today whether they are going to stand united or whether it is simply going to come to the whole cohesion process is going to come to an end. Well, it's increasingly likely that they are going to stand together, that they know that that is the only real way that Europe is going to create a strong enough economic power to last. Now, it is worth considering going back and thinking about the Dow gold ratio again, that if we go back and think about those questions, does it really represent the same kind of influence on the global economy today as it did then? One thing we know is that the Dow gold ratio is no longer consistent. The Dow oil ratio has pushed on to a new all-time peak, but is now contracting. It's impossible today to look at the influence of data. We don't have a way of monitoring it on a price basis. Perhaps the greatest way of thinking about it is Bitcoin. Bitcoin, and I really do hesitate to think about it in this basis. But it is a data market. And when we think about the foundations of the global economy, it was easy to think about stocks being about industrial production and manufacturing in the early 1900s, and gold being hard money. Then in the 1960s, we had then we've also had the increasing relevance of oil as a very significant part of the global economy, but now less so. Whereas economic activity today is concentrated in terms of data. So eventually we'll have to start thinking about the stock market representing economic activity. And the basis for money and power and value being in data. Well, it's very arguable whether Bitcoin is eventually going to be the data benchmark. I think, personally think that Bitcoin in many respects is akin to Netscape. in that it was the foundation of internet browsing, but it was superseded by Chrome and Google and then social media and evolved. The one major inhibition that Bitcoin has is speed, whereas the newer interlopers are much faster and are increasingly more decentralized. And once that is truly achieved, then we're likely to see a significant migration away from Bitcoin. It is interesting, however, that Bitcoin is steadying from the lower side of this short-term range in here this week. And we've had a very meaningful move in terms of the acceptance of the market over the course of the last few years. I think this is a really quite important change, because its data is by far the most important basis for economic activity. That's why we've had such incredible success for the FANGs, because they might all be engaged in different parts of the economy. Amazon is a consumer discretionary company, and Apple is also, should technically be in consumer discretionary. Then we have Facebook, which is a communications company, but the reality is that they are all involved in data. Now, we've had a spectacular move in that index over the course of the last few months, and it is really very overbought in the short term. So it wouldn't be at all surprising if we see consolidation here. But the bigger picture is that it really is about data. And the way that data can be greatly enhanced is through individual productivity. It's really about the individual productivity of each individual person and how well the tools and capabilities of technology generally are made available to each individual person will dictate the growth of an economy. Then that clearly behooves Europe to get its act together and create a unified group of 450 million consumers. It also represents a clear trend to provide technological innovation and education to people in the USA as the world's largest economy, but it's also the unifying factor behind China's rise. They clearly want to try and become the data dominant economy of the next century. It's also part of the reason why companies have been so eager to invest in India. Now, the Chinese market pulled back sharply again in here today. And this pace of geopolitical competition, where China is on the one hand attempting to mobilize its entire population on a digital front. In order to do that, they are trying to enhance the data economy and the domestic economy, but unfortunately they are also trying to steal whatever they require from the rest of the world and simultaneously attempting to exert their influence on a whole range of additional countries. So that's a really quite significant factor. Then we have the additional point that we're in a situation where geopolitical tensions are rising, where people have got a clear rationale for thinking that their jobs were stolen by China. Regardless of the fact that they were more likely given to China, the reality is that the jobs are no longer where they used to be, and they're unlikely to come back. The only way that that competition is going to be changed is if some form of accommodation is reached. It's very unlikely that that is going to be reached, because it would be viewed by China as a way of ensuring that they cannot reach their full potential, and that is something that they are just not going to tolerate. It means that the pace of technological innovation will increase. The competition for access to that technology will also increase. It means that the evolution of quantum computing is going to become progressively more competitive. There is already talk of creating a quantum internet to ensure that hacking is no longer possible. One of the greatest limitations of the internet as it is today is that despite the greatest efforts of companies, they're simply not able to avoid hacking. The fact that Garmin has been subject to a ransomware attack for the last 2 days is obviously a good example of that. Now, this is a significant challenge. This is something that is obviously a problem, that the quantity of money and intellectual property assets that are at risk because of a porous internet is something that is going to have to be addressed. It's really not something, it was an irritant until now, but if we're in fact talking about clear geopolitical competition and the outright theft of intellectual property, well, then it becomes a national priority, and securing data then becomes a very different situation. As we move progressively towards the evolution of artificial intelligence, where natural language artificial intelligence is on the cusp of being released, where computers can ask and answer questions as if they were people, this is something that is very rapidly improving. We're also potentially going to have autonomy in terms of transportation at some point in the next decade. And when that occurs, then it's going to, I think the kinds of questions we're asking now about how millions of people who have suddenly become unemployed are going to be redeployed will be asked again. And we are going to have to come up with an answer to that question. Individual productivity has got to improve. Education for people has got to improve. And these are very significant challenges. When we start to think about the investment implications, it does suggest that we're in for a period of risk, that there are going to be clear winners and losers. In many respects, it's probably going to be more important to avoid the losers than to miss out on the winners. That's obviously something that is going to occupy minds for the foreseeable future because of the debt problems. There are huge quantities of debt that are outstanding. We are on the cusp of a potential inflationary cycle. That's why gold continues to do well. One thing I think is also particularly relevant is to look at the performance of gold shares. They've been really quiet relative to the price of gold for most of the last decade, but it's looking increasingly likely that they will complete this base formation. We're at exactly the point in the cycle where gold shares should do well. They have not engaged in a lot of risky activity. They are not investing heavily or borrowing a ton of money to go out and invest in new mining. They're much more interested in buying out one another and M&A activity, because there's very little risk in terms of the geology in doing that. What it means is that they will continue to offer leverage to the gold price, and that is the hallmark of the gold mining sector in the early parts of a new gold bull market. And considering the fact that gold is really only starting to break out to new all-time highs in US dollars, it is relevant to think about it as a new bull market and the beginning of that cycle. If this is analogous to 1968, then we have potentially got a lengthy period where inflationary pressures will mount on a sustained period. Not simply that we're going to have an inflationary cycle unfold from 1 week to the next, but that it occurs over a lengthy period of time. There are obviously massive pieces of innovation that are occurring in the technology sector and in the healthcare sector, and they do have the potential to deliver significant value. But biotech was down in a pretty dynamic manner in here today. It pulled back in a violent manner for 4 days in a row now. Now it's going to have to hold at the region of the lows around 4,200 if this trend is going to remain consistent. I think, though, that having had a really impressive move, the intensification of stress with China is likely to tax stock market returns, and not least because investors continue to wait for news of additional stimulus from the US government. We might have to wait until the end of next week before we get clear willingness to provide an additional $1 trillion in stimulus. That could be something that will support markets. But there is a clear trend here of additional liquidity. Global central bank assets are up to 26.8 trillion. That's a lot of money. It's also worth considering that it is being supplemented by fiscal stimulus, which is up to about 1.2 trillion, and that's obviously a rolling figure, not on any simply a or because of the way that this is reported, it's not something that we can rely on 100%, but it's certainly at all-time highs. And this is just a visual representation of how willing central banks are to continue to stimulate. That, I think, is by far the most important point, that we continue to have a stimulative environment. We continue to see that central banks and governments are willing to spend money. They are willing to continue to inflate asset prices. That is going to contribute to an inflationary process. The ability of stocks to hold up on that basis is going to be linked to their ability to deliver on growth and potentially how affected they're going to be by an intensification of the competition between the USA and China. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.